It's not long from now, not as long as it seems, in a place perhaps you've heard in your dreams. It's the CFRU fundraising drive, the place that keeps local culture alive. It's not ghostly spirits that keep us on air, it's listeners like you and people that care.
The CFRU Fundraising Drive, October 23rd to the 31st. Show your support to local programming. Stay posted for details of the many ghoulish events to come. It is not a trick, it's a treat.
For the latest adventures in modern music, listen to Sounds from the Tall House with your host, Michael Mucci. Every other Sunday from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, right here on CFRU 93.3 FM.
Action Read Community Literacy Center offers one-on-one tutoring and small group learning in reading, writing, math, and computers for adults aged 18 and over in Guelph. At Action Read, we help you identify what you're good at so you can work towards your goals. Learn skills to get the job you want, to work on personal budgets, creative writing projects, for test preparation, and to improve study skills. Our services are free and no referral is needed. If Action Read sounds like the place for you or someone you know, contact us at 519-836-2759 or visit us on the web at actionread.com.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 22nd, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, in D.C., lawmakers examine the Department of Homeland Security's response to the BP oil disaster. Indigenous groups from Canada and the U.S. join to express concern over a controversial oil pipeline project. And world leaders debate progress on the UN's Millennium Development Goals. We'll look at one South American country that has shown strides in fighting poverty. Those stories and more coming up after these headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two of the 1,600 victims of a recent outbreak of salmonella poisoning were at the Capitol today, testifying about their experiences with the illness and decrying the conditions at the poultry farms where the egg contamination occurred. The conditions included piles of manure in the hen houses.
Loose chickens walking through the manure piles and laying their eggs inside. 31 live mice observed in the hen house. Live and dead flies too numerous to count inside the hen houses.
Carol Lobato of Colorado became sick with salmonella in July. She said she was appalled at the conditions after having raised chickens at her family farm as a child.
Our farm never looked the way these two farms look.
The two farms at the source of the salmonella outbreak are Wright County Egg Farm and Hillendale Farms in Iowa. The owners, who have been repeatedly cited with safety violations at the state level, apologized to those who had gotten sick from their eggs. At the hearing before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, lawmakers pushed for passage of a food safety bill stalled now for more than a year in the Senate. Committee Chair Bart Stupak.
Make no mistake about it. Without legislative action, it is not a matter of if, but when more lives will be put at risk by another outbreak.
The legislation would allow the FDA to issue mandatory recalls, provide them a steady funding source, and implement so-called traceback regulations that would allow for quicker identification of the source of contaminated food. Democrats are blaming Republican Senator Tom Coburn for blocking the bill because he wants cost offsets included. Republicans blame Majority Leader Harry Reid for not bringing the legislation to the floor. Lawrence Summers, the Obama administration's top economic advisor, confirmed he is leaving his post at the end of the year. Summers originally signed on for a two-year stint. He's considered the man behind Obama's economic policies. The departure raises speculation that Obama may turn to a corporate player to replace the ex-Harvard president in order to mend ties with big business. A U.S. district judge today approved an $8.25 million settlement for about 400 people who were arrested en masse at Washington, D.C.'s Pershing Park. The arrests came during an anti-globalization protest in 2002. Plaintiffs charged that the protesters were not given notice to disperse before police moved in. Many were also hogtied and held for longer than 24 hours. Virginia plans to go ahead with the execution of 41-year-old Teresa Lewis after the U.S. Supreme Court denied her lawyer's request to examine new evidence. Brad Kuttner reports from Richmond.
Since being sentenced for plotting the murder of her husband and stepson in 2002, independent psychological reviews have suggested that Teresa Lewis's IQ is close enough to the threshold for mental retardation that she should be ineligible for execution. This data, combined with a written note from trigger man Matthew Schallenberger, claiming he manipulated Lewis into the murder plot, was the crux of Lewis's attorney's request. The U.S. Supreme Court denied the stay of execution 7-2. Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor were the only two justices to rule in favor of Lewis. After Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell denied a request for clemency late last week, there was little standing between Lewis and her lethal injection scheduled for Thursday evening. Lewis would be the first woman executed in Virginia in almost 100 years. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
An appeals court in Florida today ruled 3-0. It is unconstitutional for the state to ban gays from adopting children. In the ruling, the judges stated there is no rational basis for the three-decade-old statute and pointed out that all parties involved in the suit agreed there was no difference in the parenting abilities of gay and heterosexual people. The case is expected to be appealed to the Florida Supreme Court. Two Greenpeace activists in Great Britain have attached themselves to the anchor of a Chevron oil drilling ship. The activists are trying to prevent the ship from leaving to begin a drilling operation in the waters off Scotland. Greenpeace says the activists intend to stay at their posts for up to a month, living in suspended tent-like structures. On the Greenpeace website, one of the activists, identified as Victor, described an early interaction with a crew member.
Well, they kindly asked us, could you get away from there? And I said, yeah, if I get to talk to the boss. And he promised me that you will not go out drilling in the deep sea, then we might consider going off. But the boss didn't come.
The group wants the British government to stop issuing permits for offshore drilling operations, citing the massive spill in the Gulf of Mexico. This comes just a week after BP's CEO, wanting to drill off the Shetland Islands as well, defended the company's deepwater drilling operations and record. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. In the aftermath of BP's oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, lawmakers are taking a closer look at the federal response to the disaster. In a hearing in Washington, D.C. today, panelists focused on the Department of Homeland Security and its ability to respond to disasters. But some regional officials are saying the focus also needs to stay local. Matt Laszlo reports.
Remember when we first heard that an oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, taking 11 lives with it? Initial reports said no oil was leaking. Then it was reported some oil was leaking. 4 days later, the public was informed of a very serious oil spill. According to Greg Tafaro, the president of St. Bernard Parish, Louisiana, the government was already behind at that point.
And if we're going to respond to disasters, in my estimation, it's much better to overwhelm the response at the front end than play catch-up at the back end.
The government tried to play catch-up, but Tafaro told the House Homeland Security Committee the government responded to this bill largely on its own.
It is noted that the interaction between the St. Bernard Parish branch and the Department of Homeland Security was non-existent.
Officials provided St. Bernard Parish with a Coast Guard liaison, but Tafaro says he was never consulted by the Department of Interior, which handled the environmental impact of the spill. Tafaro says untold acres of marshland washed away from his coast. That possibly could have been prevented, especially because BP was given so much authority initially.
Very early on in the response, St. Bernard Parish requested BP to allow for and support the establishment of a local environmental planning and assessment team. This was disallowed by BP, only to be told some 3.5 months later by a visiting Coast Guard authority that St. Bernard should have been involved in environmental assessment from the start.
Some members of the committee agreed the federal government was not prepared for such a disaster. Committee Chair Benny Thompson of Mississippi says the Department of Homeland Security is what the public ought to rely on in emergencies.
The department did not have a role in reviewing or assessing the plans for the response and recovery of this type of disaster. The agency that regulated the industry reviewed the response plan.
Homeland Security officials are tasked with planning and reviewing all emergency plans, but the agency says it lacks an adequate number of planners. Thus, it relies on other agencies, regulators included. Tafaro says the government had multiple layers of responders to the oil spill that never consulted one another, only making his job on the ground harder. New Jersey Democrat Bill Pascrell had a simple question for Tafaro.
What do you expect from us, Mr. Tafaro? What do you want us to do? Tell me what you want me to do.
If this committee can address the link between the National Incident Command and the National Contingency Plan and make sure that those dots are connected all the way to the ground level forces that are on the front line of any disaster, then I think we have accomplished something.
Actor Kevin Costner, who has invested heavily in oil response technology, also testified. He asked the panel to consider a nearly $900 million oil spill response plan. It includes investing in 190 high-tech ships that could separate oil from water in the immediate aftermath of a spill. Matt Laszlo, FSRN Washington.
Also in Washington, D.C., a delegation representing indigenous communities from both the U.S. and Canada met with government officials regarding the impact of tar sands development. The tar sands of northern Alberta contain the second largest oil deposit in the world, according to the Canadian government. Leaders are concerned that construction of an oil pipeline, now under review by the Obama administration, could be culturally and environmentally destructive. Michael Lawson reports.
Canada is the largest exporter of oil to the United States, which is the world's largest consumer. Indigenous or First Nations communities in Alberta say they have felt the brunt of this relationship. Francois Bonlette is a former chief of the Dene Nation and a part of the delegation who came to Washington to share First Nations concerns with U.S. officials. He said the tar sands operation's impact on the Athabasca River and its surroundings is obvious.
When I travel the river today, I need to bring fresh drinking water. 20 years ago or so, I didn't have to do that.
At issue is the proposed 1,700-mile-long Keystone XL pipeline that would carry 900,000 barrels per day of what critics called dirty oil through seven states to refineries in Texas. Keystone XL has already been approved by Canadian authorities and awaits approval by the State Department. Supporters of the pipeline say it is essential in reducing U.S. dependence on oil from the Middle East. Critics wonder at what cost. The tar sands cover an area the size of Florida and are a mixture of sand, clay, and a heavy crude oil called bitumen. To retrieve the bitumen, deforestation must first take place and then it has to be cooked with steam, using water from the nearby Athabasca River. Marty Cabanis is a member of the nonprofit Indigenous Environmental Network and has encouraged resolutions among tribal leaders in the U.S. opposing the Keystone XL pipeline.
All these pipelines, the Keystone, the Alberta Clipper, and now the Keystone XL pipeline, was really started during the Bush administration, and President Bush said that we needed them for our national interest. That is the big thing, is for the national interest. So these pipelines have been pushed from the top level down for approval, and that's where we're fighting.
In June, 250 members of Environmental Entrepreneurs sent a letter to Secretary Hillary Clinton expressing concern that continued oil sands production undermines the growth of the clean energy economy. The EPA sent a letter on July 16th to the State Department saying its draft environmental impact study required additional information and analysis on the need for the pipeline in light of other goals set for reducing greenhouse gas emissions and protecting wildlife. Susan Casey Lefkowitz is director of the International Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Citing the Deepwater Horizon spill, she says the pursuit of more risky and dangerous sources of oil, like that in the tar sands, is not the right direction.
The substance itself takes a lot more upgrading and refining in order to be made into gasoline. And so the lesson we really should be taking is that now is the time to be looking for alternatives beyond oil, instead of trying to get every last drop out of our oceans and our land.
The Assembly of First Nations, which represents 700,000 First Nations people across Canada, has called for the U.S. government to realize the effects of increasing oil sands development on its members. Paulette says that is what brought him to Washington.
And I just ask the American people to rethink your plan, to rethink what you're doing, to rethink what you're about to do, that you're going to enable climate change, you're going to enable the continuation and the destruction of the environment and its people.
Recently, opponents displayed deformed fish they say was taken from Lake Athabasca, downstream of the oil sands in Alberta. A coalition of scientists, doctors, First Nation leaders, and local residents is calling on the Canadian government to conduct an independent study on the health and safety of oil sands development. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
In the last 2 days, two service members with the U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan have been killed in explosions. This follows the deaths this week of 9 U.S. and allied troops in a helicopter crash. The incidents make 2010 the deadliest year for NATO forces since the war began 9 years ago. Since 2001, some 2,100 NATO troops have died, according to iCasualties.org. But the number of those wounded in Afghanistan has also been increasing. According to the Department of Defense, more than 8,000 U.S. troops have been wounded in the Afghan war. Many more suffer from a condition called traumatic brain injury. A RAND Corporation study says 1 in 5 service members from Iraq and Afghanistan show signs of it. One of them is Ryan Lamke. He's a retired corporal with the Marines and works now as an outreach coordinator for the Wounded Warrior Project. That's a nonprofit that offers services to severely injured veterans. He joined FSRN earlier today by mobile phone from the Walter Reed Medical Center. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
You were deployed to Fallujah in Iraq as an infantry assaultman with the Marines. What kind of injuries did you sustain?
Well, I was in a series of IEDs and RPG blasts that left me with a traumatic brain injury, as well as my left wrist being fairly messed up and my left knee also having some problems.
And what happened? Were you able to return home after that? Did you stay in Iraq after the injuries?
Well, I stayed in theater and, in fact, went on another deployment. It wasn't until about 2 years after the incident that they diagnosed me with a traumatic brain injury. I had had several migraines, had trouble sleeping, my memory had started to decrease, and during a post-deployment health assessment for a following deployment, they found that I had a lot of symptoms that were concurrent with traumatic brain injury. So they sent me to get medically evaluated, and it was at that time that they determined that I should not be deployable, and they sent me to the Wounded Warrior Battalion down at Camp Lejeune.
So during those 2 years after the injury took place, but as those symptoms came out, did the symptoms come out all at once? Was it slow?
Well, it was a slow progression. There was a lot of stress, obviously, given my occupation. So I boiled a lot of it down into stress issues. After time, I started realizing that even when I wasn't stressed, I was having these same issues. So I started, seeking medical help for it and just going, hey, I have basic issues. And they quickly were, found to be a ulterior issue.
You work now as a counselor with recently wounded soldiers. What are you seeing with the men and women that you work with?
First of all, I'm seeing a lot of much more severe injuries than what we're seeing in the early years of the Iraq War. But what I'm also seeing is guys who, when they're coming out of service, are struggling to find jobs, struggling to find their way in school, and overall needing of greater assistance than what has been needed in the past for our veterans.
And tell us about some of the soldiers you work with. What are their challenges when they return home?
Some of the challenges may include understanding of, their prosthetic devices, things of that nature, why they're on prosthetics, why they have these injuries, handicap accommodations for individuals with traumatic brain injury who are trying to return to school, basic understanding of post-traumatic stress, and destigmatizing the disorder.
You talk about the stigma of PTSD. What about traumatic brain injury? Are there misunderstandings about that condition? And what has been your experience in dealing with it?
Well, a lot of times, especially with mild traumatic brain injuries, people don't understand necessarily that individuals are injured to begin with. They look at them and go, well, I don't see any wounds. You seem fine. You seem like you can talk. They don't understand the underlying difficulties that an individual with this issue faces on a daily basis. They often think that, oh, you have a brain injury, therefore you have serious cognitive issues. You can't speak. You can't conduct yourself in a normal fashion anymore. But the fact of the matter is many people with mild traumatic brain injuries with medical assistance, can go on to lead fairly normal lives.
There's a bill in Congress now. It's called the Veterans Traumatic Brain Injury Rehabilitative Services Improvement Act, and it would require the Department of Veteran Affairs to provide veterans who do have severe injuries with ongoing long-term rehabilitative care. Do you see that as a step forward, or what other improvements can be made?
Any step to provide more care for our veterans is a step in the right direction. The fact of the matter is, many TBI facilities or many VA facilities don't provide adequate TBI care currently. And that leads veterans to have to relocate or travel regularly to get that necessary traumatic brain injury care. By requiring the VA to be more comprehensive in their care, it allows individuals to go home to where they came from, to where they feel is home, and still be able to lead a fairly normal life while getting the care that they so desperately need.
Corporal Ryan Lampke, I know we reached you on the road today. Where exactly are you right now?
Right now I'm at Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
And you're headed on a program?
We are reconning a program today, a fishing program that hopefully we can get more warriors out on down in southern Maryland, just to allow them to get out with fellow veterans, throw a line in the water, and be able to relax a little bit.
Ryan Lampke is a retired corporal with the U.S. Marine Corps and an outreach coordinator with the Wounded Warrior Project. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
President Obama began a three-day visit to the United Nations this afternoon. He's expected to outline a new foreign policy agenda addressing nuclear disarmament, Middle East peace, and global poverty. The speech comes as world leaders continue to debate the Millennium Development Goals. The UN admits that progress to reduce poverty has been uneven and that many of the targets for 2015 will be missed. But some countries have shown promise. Brazil is one of the few that is ahead of the 2015 deadline. It has already met half the targets set for the development goals and is well on track for the rest. Salim Rizvi reports.
The latest UN MDG report shows some progress has been made. Officials expect the global poverty rate to drop to 15% by 2015. That would be about 920 million people, half the number living in poverty in 1990. According to the UN Development Programme or UNDP, China, India, Vietnam and Brazil have made major gains in reducing poverty. Darcy O'Canahan is the International Policy Director with non-profit organization Food and Water Watch. She explains why Brazil has been more successful in achieving the MDGs.
I think overall Brazil is doing a better job of meeting some of the MDGs than other countries because of their overall rising incomes and improved health care that relates to that. They've put a plan in place, which you're now seeing the results of, which is a great example for other countries in the region and in the world.
Brazil, which has a population of about 190 million people, has not only tackled poverty, but also the highest youth illiteracy rate in the region. In 2003, Brazilian President Lula da Silva's government embarked on a strong social welfare agenda and established priorities to mobilize resources. A national movement was launched around the Millennium Development Goals by bringing together civil society organizations, government agencies, and the private sector to promote economic growth with social inclusion. Under the motto, I can, you can, we can, hundreds of volunteers were organized nationally to champion the MDGs on the grassroots level. In addition, since 2003, Brazilian supermarkets, media outlets, banks, and even carnivals have promoted the Millennium Development Goals. Brazilian President Lula da Silva, speaking through a translator at the UN last year, said his government was able to avoid the worst effects of the global recession and continue the anti-poverty measures.
We intensified our social policies, particularly income transfer programs. We raised wages above inflation rates. We used fiscal measures to stimulate consumption and keep the economy moving.
As part of meeting the millennium targets, the Brazilian government focused on reducing the number of poor and hungry people with zero hunger and family grant programs. Under the zero hunger program, the government provided food or food tickets to families suffering from malnutrition and unemployment. Its popular program of cash transfer, Bolsa Familia, or family grant, played a key role in achieving the poverty reduction goals. The initiative provides around $100 a month, generally to mothers, with conditions that their children must attend school and get vaccinated. The government says since 2003, this program has helped more than 70 million people come out of poverty and improve their access to education and health. During this summit, many non-profit organizations are looking at how countries like Brazil are reaching the development goals. Tariq Chima is the chief executive officer of the World Congress of Muslim Philanthropists.
One of the reasons we convene here in United Nations is to basically share our experience and learn from the successful models that we are around. So achieving MDGs, as we all know, does not seem to be a very easy goal, but there are nations who have done well, and partly it is because of their stability and their democratic regimes, and then comes the good governance.
Brazil is already sharing its anti-poverty program models with a number of countries, including Chile, India, Cuba, and Kenya, to help them achieve the MDGs. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
Reducing hunger is one of the top Millennium Development Goals. While countries work to increase food security, the UN's World Food Program, or WFP, is developing more efficient ways to track hunger and map out where to provide resources. Today we take you to Burundi, where the World Food Program provides assistance to more than 500,000 people and has launched a new initiative. Zach Badorf reports.
Since 1968, when the World Food Program arrived in Burundi, staff have been heading out to villages to conduct food security surveys in order to gauge where there is need. Mark Nielsen is the public information officer for WFP Burundi. He says it helps them stay on top of the country's food supply.
Usually you'll send out someone like a monitor with lots of forms, and it's a very simple process of interviewing a potential beneficiary or someone who lives in that particular area about their food needs, their food requirements, their living standards. And you simply jot down what they say on paper, or you may have a questionnaire or a form with you in paper form, and then you check boxes as needed with a pen.
But that manual process takes time and resources, so the agency began a new initiative. WFP program assistant Gerard Bisman interviews Elizabeth Tembaidai, a Burundian woman in Bihogo village. As she responds, Bisman types her answers directly into a handheld personal digital assistant, or PDA. The light palm-top computer is a little larger than a normal cell phone. The devices have held up against the Burundian heat and can last for days before needing a recharge. Since he started using the device in March, Bisman says the result is more accuracy and efficiency because there's no prep time and no paper shuffling.
It's very interesting to use the device because it's a lot faster. It used to take us about an hour and a half to complete the entire interview with paper, and now it takes only half an hour.
The WFP staffer says the survey takers appreciate the improved technology too and provide more accurate data because they're not as tired. Today, Elizabeth Tembaidai is taking the survey. The 56-year-old primary school teacher had never been interviewed before by WFP and said it's the first time for her to see such a device. A few years ago, Tembaidai received food aid from WFP because she said there was a food shortage in her village due to a drought. She hopes WFP will supply them with food this year, too.
It's a good thing.
Well, we will probably need some help in regards to food this year, because the water that used to come up from the north doesn't come up anymore. It's a dry season also, and we are short of food at the moment, and we are asking WFP for some food now.